Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John, firstly.
And good evening to you, Ben, and hi, everybody.
Hi, everyone. Indeed, as usual, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. You can also catch us live on dublincityfm.ie on Tinternet and also as a podcast. And lots to get through, as usual, in the next 28 minutes. So we'll get straight into it, John, with what to see in the night sky.
Okay, just starting, when is the 17th? 3 days away. International Space Station back in our evening skies. Great to see. This one came around much quicker than the last one for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe we just wasn't waiting for it or something. Anyway, November the 17th to December the 6th. Put that in your diary. We'll be giving you a little bit more time, although you can quickly Google it and find it when it's flying over Dublin. Where to see it? To go out through the front door or the back door, whichever is facing south. And it always comes in just quite high, actually, from the south-west. I had to think about that once for a minute. We know exactly where it's coming from. You just look up, and when we give you the time, you've got, it comes in exactly when it's, what it does, and it says on the tin as well, so looking forward to that. Again, for the whole month of November until December the 6th. Mercury, unfortunately, hidden deep in the afterglow of sunset. It's directly behind, unviewable, and Venus, a great sight early in the morning, minus 4.4 under the hind feet of Leo at the moment. It shines high in the southeast before and during dawn and arises nearly 2.5 hours before dawn's first light. Now, you said to me earlier on that you saw Venus
During
the daytime at 11 o'clock in the morning with a high power pair of binoculars.
Yes. I couldn't see it with the naked eye, even when I knew where it was. Actually, it was the morning, which we spoke about last week, about the occultation of Venus by the moon, when the moon came in front of Venus, blocked it out. Half past 10 was the last Wednesday morning, Thursday morning. And I knew, it came out from the other side of the moon at about half past 10. And so once I found the moon with my 15 by 70s, looked a little bit to the right, and I could see Venus. First time I ever saw Venus during
the day,
daylight, clear sky. Now, only because I knew where it was, I tried to then pick it out with the naked eye, even though I knew where exactly it was. But it was hard enough to pick out the moon, although I think it was about 15, the moon was about 15% phase at that stage, or maybe a bit more perhaps.
Yeah, the moon is a great sight first thing in the morning as well against the bluish sky. Rather than the dark black sky, it's an interesting thing to photograph as well. Jupiter, on the other hand, minus 2.9, still very bright at the moment. I saw it earlier on, about 6 o'clock. It's barely past its November 2nd opposition at the moment. It rises just around sunset and dominates the east during evening. A sunset is quite early at the moment, Ben, because it gets dark rather rapidly. So it's dark now, just before 5 o'clock.
Yeah, I'll give you those times in a moment.
Yeah, that's Mars, unfortunately, as well. It's directly behind the glare of the sun as well, so we're not going to see it for a while. I think we've lost some communications between Earth and Mars just for another week or so. So we'll get that back shortly as well. Saturn, magnitude plus 0.7. It's still easy enough to see this one, actually, and I found it remarkable because it is so dim. It's in Aquarius at the moment, glows steadily yellowish high in the southeast these evenings, and it's bright, and it's not supposed to twinkle, but it twinkles a little bit. Uranus, it's east of Jupiter at the moment by about 11 degrees. It comes to opposition on It came to opposition yesterday, in fact, in a small telescope of high power. Uranus is a tiny but distinctly non-stellar ball. And sort of a bluey type of a colour. Neptune, on the other hand, magnitude 7.8, more difficult to see. And it's high in the early evening, 25 degrees east of Saturn. And Neptune is only 2.3 arcseconds wide at the moment, so it's hard to resolve as a ball. But it's definitely a non-stellar at high power. Now, I just want to go back just where we are, because we're creeping up to the 19th at the moment. And as you see a half-lit moon over to the left on the 11 o'clock mark, about two moon diameters across, you'll see Saturn. On the 21st, roughly in the same position, you will see Neptune. On the 25th, Jupiter is just to the right of the moon. That's a full moon around then. And Uranus is just to the left of that as well. And if you look a little bit further over to the right at the 27th, you'll see M45 if you have a good pair of binoculars or a telescope as well. So something to look forward to, and easier to see when you have, I suppose, the moon is guiding its way, because all of the planets and the moon and sun, everything, follow the same pattern within a degree or two. So again, dates to remember, the 17th until the 6th for the International Space Station. So looking forward to that.
Thank you, John. Speaking of the moon, of course, it is very, very small, waning crescent at the moment. It's only 2.5%, very difficult to see. Well, you won't see it from our vantage point here in Dublin this evening, because it is below the horizon, but it will rise tomorrow morning, just about 10 minutes to 11 or so. Even then, it'll only be a mere 5% waxing crescent moon. And when it's due south at tomorrow, it'll be 5.5%. But by the time it sets tomorrow evening at 5:10, it'll be a 6% moon, as we slowly come up to the first quarter moon, a whole week away, almost. That will be next Monday, the 20th. And the sun, which we mentioned, the day's getting shorter, and the sun will rise tomorrow in Dublin. That's Wednesday, the 15th, at 7:49 a.m., 13 minutes later than a week ago. A local noon is at 9 minutes past 12. That's when the sun passes the meridian, or at its highest point. And when it sets tomorrow, it'll be only 4:29 p.m. Can you believe it? 11 minutes earlier than a week ago. Also, 9 to 11 minutes earlier than a week ago, our civil twilight, which ends at just after 5:05. Nautical twilight ending at 10 minutes to 6. And astronomical twilight ending and nighttime beginning at 6:31 p.m. So that means we have 24 minutes. We will have 24 minutes less daylight tomorrow than we had a week ago. Tomorrow, another 3 minutes and 21 seconds less daylight than today, when there will be 8 hours and 40 minutes between sunrise and sunset. That doesn't seem like long at all, no, now, does it? And the days are to get shorter yet. Actually, John, you mentioned Uranus at opposition up there in Aries. It's at a distance of 18.63 astronomical units from us, one astronomical unit being the mean distance between the sun and the earth. So over 18.5 times further away than the sun is. And just briefly, on the night of Saturday, or Friday night and Saturday morning, next 17 and 18, the Leonids meteor showers.
Pete. That's right. And a moon-free sky.
Hopefully. Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah. Yes. And then, as you mentioned, on how to find Saturn, also on Saturn on Monday the 20th in the evening, that Saturn a mere 3.5 degrees to the upper right of the moon.
Yeah, it's interesting. Nice to see everything. Now, if I was to mention Lost in Space, you'll immediately think of the Robinson family and Dr. Zachary Smith. If you're in our vintage. First of all, we used to see it in black and white, and then it eventually came into color.
Oh, what was the robot's name, do you remember? Was he Robert the Robot? No.
Do you know, I can't remember what the robot's name is. We're going on a mission. Yeah, warning, Will Robinson.
Remember yes, that? I was about to do my impression of the robot.
Robot impression, but it's a fantastic robot as well. Anyway, Lost in Space, it's actually this week one of the space walkers from NASA lost a tool bag, worth $100,000 from a NASA spacewalk. And I suppose it's every construction worker's nightmare who accidentally leaves their tools here, there and everywhere, even drops one off a building or something like that. But $100,000 worth of a tool bag. I'm not sure what's in this. And this tool bag, which is orbiting in the sky just ahead of the space station just at the moment, is shining just below the limit of visibility with the unaided eye, where it could be seen with minimal health help. But you can't actually see it, seemingly. But sure, with your...
They're not that powerful. From the space station.
Yeah, that's it.
So not the first time a tool kit has been lost.
No.
I remember seeing, as many years ago, during a spacewalk, one of the female astronauts, she lost her tool kit. You'd see it, I saw it floating away, but it's just out of reach. You can't go after it.
Yep.
Because the astronauts, naturally enough, are tethered to the... They don't float off, which would be completely disastrous.
Now, those
it's only money.
Who might be worried about the tools falling on someone's head here on Earth, the experts have said there is no chance of that happening whatsoever. The tool bag is expected to remain in orbit for a few more months before it will descend and promptly disintegrate in the Earth's atmosphere, and it should meet its fiery fate around March, according to Earth Sky. And it has a name, would you believe?
The toolbox?
It's been officially catalogued as Space Junk ID 58229-1998-067WC.
Okay, that's enough.
Yeah.
It has a catalogue number.
They have to do these.
Yeah, because they are tracking tens of thousands of pieces of debris.
Would you believe there are 130 million pieces of space junk? Bits of flakes of paint up there.
Every little grain of dust.
Yeah, anything at all, yes. But a lot of it will come back eventually down and just get burnt up in space. But the toolkit itself will just become a blob and then disappear and disintegrate. We'll probably see it and think it's a meteor.
But that's possible too, yes. Now, yes, of course, you're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And we're also live on the World Wide Web at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. Now, the sun may be a little smaller than we thought it was, but... up to now, it was widely accepted and since the 1970s that the sun's radius, which is, of course, half its diameter, was 695,990 kilometers. But a new measurement technique being used recently seems to bring it in at a mere 695,780 kilometers, which is... not an awful lot different. It is 210 kilometers of a difference and or 420 with regard to the diameter. And you say, well, but that's not a lot. I know you might say to yourself, in fact, it's only somewhere between 0.03% and 0.07% of a difference. But apparently you need to, the more accurate you can measure the actual size of the sun, the better you can understand the physics and how you can calculate certain other aspects of its behavior, about the processes that go on within it, and its magnetic field and sunspots and how they form. Basically, everything that goes on the sun. If you know the mass, the more accurately you know the mass and the more accurately you know the dimensions of it, the more accurately you can calculate and understand the other phenomena that happens in the sun. So 210 kilometers is not a lot. What's the difference? What's the difference from Dublin, distance from Dublin to Cork?
It's must be something 160 kilometers, but 160 miles is about 220 kilometers thereabouts.
That's essentially the difference Dublin to Cork.
No,
not much on such a massive star.
Yeah.
Well, compared with the Earth. Not particularly huge compared with other stars.
Yeah. Now, I had our encyclopedia, Alanica, who has been listening down in County Kildare. Good evening to you all. And he's queried, or he's questioned, he says, hi, they mean visible from Earth via binoculars. That's the toolbox, because I have a photograph of it here, actually, and it is a shiny box, and metallic box reflects light as well and flares up on rotation, so you get this flashy effect, so which is interesting. So that sort of confirms that we could, through a pair of binoculars, see the the runaway toolbox. Worth $100,000 if somebody wants to go up and try and get it. Add to the connection. Wonder what's in it.
Spanners, wrenches, screwdrivers.
But it's unusual now for something like that to become untethered and disappear and sort of break away from the space station. But who's going to get in trouble for that one? So, there we go. Now, Airbus has introduced a de-tumbler device to address the satellite tumbling in low Earth orbit. And this is a magnetic gadget of some sort to try and stop it spinning so they can control where it might go in the future and things like that. So we'll have to keep an eye on that particular one as well. Just noticed here as well, Ben, that Frank Borman, the NASA astronaut who led the 1968 Apollo mission, and he was the first human spaceflight to reach the moon, has died at the age of 95. Ooh. Now, there's a good innings.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that. Very famous, well-known name in the space industry.
Yeah, so
those of us who go back as far as vaguely remember the Apollo missions.
Yep, of a current vintage, ourselves maybe, perhaps. And he passed away on November the 7th, which is only last week, in a place called Billings in Montana. So he had a lifelong love for aviation and exploration, was only surpassed by the love of his wife, Susan. So may he rest in peace.
Indeed, may he, yes. Now, SpaceX, you may remember back in, was it April? Oh, yes, on April 20th, when they launched their first Starship, which is the most powerful rocket ever built, but not all the engines fired, and they pressed the self-destruct button, and it did disintegrate over the Gulf of Mexico, I believe. But they are planning, SpaceX are, to relaunch Starship. In fact, they plan to do it next week. They haven't quite got the clearance yet from, would you believe, some of the people that have to sign off include the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, I suppose. Mm. In a way, it does. It seems odd in one way, but then I suppose it makes sense, because it could, if it does crash into the sea, you don't want it to do too much environmental damage. I don't know whether you saw the picture at the time, John, from the underside of it, when it was launched, that not all the engines were firing. There were about six or eight or so, you could see, weren't firing. It's a big, massive amount of engines on the bottom. Is it 20 or something like that? Can't remember exactly. But the Federal Aviation Administration, they will also need to issue a launch license for the second test to be attempted. The rocket, Starship, stands 120 meters tall and produces 74.3 meganewtons of thrust. And when you compare that with the Saturn V rocket that launched those Apollo astronauts to the moon, that's actually twice the thrust. So it is the most powerful rocket ever built. And, of course, SpaceX and Elon Musk, isn't he building the lander?
Yep.
For the lunar lander.
Yep.
Which, I suppose they're going in 2 years' time yet, but I don't think they have one built. But anyway, more of that anon. We'll keep an eye out for that next week. Apparently, it's currently on the launch pad, just waiting for the go ahead, and they'll fuel it and launch it next week with a bit of luck.
Yep, there we go. Just another couple of texts in from Alan. Good evening again. Frank's had two sons, Ed and Fred, and they were taller than him by their teens, seemingly. And it's nice and clear down in Kildare. Is it James Lovell? Isn't it James Lovell?
Yeah.
He's the oldest one, seemingly, at the moment. The oldest astronaut. He's a week younger than Frank Borman, and he's also 95 as well. So there we go. So, and he was also said, clear and mild here in County Kildare. Nice to hear from you. There's a good few texts in from him, so he's in good form this evening, which is great to see. Yeah. Now, Christmas presents.
No.
Yeah.
So no, you can't mention the C word.
Well, we can. Yeah, this is November, Mr. Seemingly.
Exactly.
A new word that they're doing as well. So Nora Patton has a book out called Shooting for the Stars. That'd be a good one. It's one of these beautifully illustrated by Jennifer Farley. You're going to embark on a fascinating journey. And she hails from Ballinan, County Mayo. And she is no ordinary dreamer. Follow Nora's extraordinary journey high above the earth and into the vastness of space. So that would be a nice one to see. Lunar calendars, they're another good idea for people who are into spacey stuff. Space socks. Everybody has to have a pair of space socks. And the biggest one probably we're looking are telescopes or binoculars. So something on the list to do for that as well. Yep, that's Shooting for the Stars. I've mentioned that one before. And there's another one as well called The Science of Spin from Roland Enos. And if you've ever wondered why the Earth is round and how boomerangs gracefully twist in midair, this is the one for you. All available at Easton's, and I suppose in the middle of O'Connell Street there, one of the other shops.
Thank you, John.
Yep. Now, how do we avoid getting disoriented in space? I nearly said disorientated, although it sounds quite good.
That's right. Isn't that right?
Well, we have disoriented in space here. And when landing on the moon's surface, astronauts can become spatially disoriented. I wonder, is that just a misprint? Anyway, which is when they lose sense of their orientation. They might not be able to tell when up is up and down is down, etc. And how they get away with this, they've got this technology which would have little gyroscopes and all sorts of things in them as well. So this is technology getting on a bit. And spatial disorientation led to the loss of 65 aircraft, would you believe, between 1993 and 2013. So it is a problem up there that we don't realise that is a problem, and something that the astronauts do suffer with, which is quite amazing, because if you were to stand on the moon, you have a certain amount of gravity, but I suppose it's just from coming out of space and then down and then same, which is up, which is down, etc. So they're looking into that one. So little magnets and things in your spacesuit and gyroscopes and all that sort of stuff, and things called vibro tractors communicate information through touch receptors, would you believe? And that sends something to the brain and sets everything straight.
So yeah, important to know which way is up and down. I know a lot of the astronauts, when they, even veterans who may have had two or three flights previously, when they get there, they can be a bit disorientated and get a bit, bit of motion sickness because they don't know which way is up and down. Happens to well-seasoned sailors, apparently, as well.
It would.
They back on land on shore for a couple of months, and then when they go back to sea, a lot of them can feel seasick again. Meanwhile, lights in the sky of Mars. See that?
Oh,
not
yes.
Quite aurora, but it discovered these green lights and red lights, and they've tracked down the actual cause of it. And apparently what happens is that, of course, the Martian atmosphere is very thin, very tenuous, and mostly carbon dioxide. And during the daytime, especially during summer, depending on what hemisphere you're in on Mars, the carbon dioxide from the energy of the sun will dissociate. It basically split off the carbon and the oxygen. And then the oxygen over the period of, I was going to say 6 months, but I think it's about 9 months, isn't it? The half year on Mars, it basically the molecule will go around, travel through the wind on Mars around to the far side, and then 6 or 9 months or 12 months later, that actually the oxygen, it combines the oxygen atoms combine into oxygen molecules, and that causes a little bit of fluorescence, gives off a little bit of radiation energy in the form of light. If you remember your chemistry, dissociation. Yeah, chemistry. I can't even say it any longer.
It's not yesterday or the day before.
But it's a bit like aurora, and from that point of view, because you're talking about the chemical and physical interactions of oxygen and nitrogen in the atmosphere, causing those colors.
Yeah.
This is kind of different. The carbon dioxide disassociates and then reforms again and causes that fluorescence and lights in the sky. Saw a picture of it, nice green light, not like the colours in the curtains that you get in aurora, just a, a different type of green glow in the whole atmosphere.
Yeah, which is nice. Yeah, I like that as well. Just reminded by Alan again on the text. First Irish satellite is to launch at the end of the month. Fingers crossed. Yes. And there's rideshare with others to, on the launch from the Vandenberg base in California. So with a bit of luck, we'll have a bit more news on that.
Yes, we did cover that last week, and I'm hoping to get to talk to somebody about that. Maybe even get them in here.
Yeah, I'll be fingers crossed on that one.
My efforts so far have been unsuccessful.
Yep.
Curiosity, we'll keep trying.
Yep. The Curiosity rover has clocked up 4,000 sols on Mars, which is 8,000 days on our own planet here as well. So 4,000 Martian days after setting its wheels in the Gale Crater on August the 5th, 2012. The Curiosity rover remains busy conducting exciting science. It's remarkable how they make these last. They only say that they're going to last maybe a couple of months or something like that, but years and years later they go. So the technology, electronics, whatever's involved is absolutely mind-blowing in that. So, and it's up there to study whether ancient Mars had the conditions to support microbial life, and the rover has been gradually ascending the base of the 3-mile-tall Mount Sharp, if you've been keeping an eye on that one, whose layers have formed in different periods of Martian history and offer a record of how the planet's climate changed over time. Again, not yesterday or the day before, but millions of years ago.
And speaking of millions and billions of years ago, in fact, 2 billion years ago, there was a gamma ray burst, which was picked up quite recently here on Earth. It was an 800-second long gamma ray burst, and although it was so far off, came from so far away, 2,000 million light years, it was so strong, I'm glad we weren't any nearer to it, that it was actually picked up by, it activated lightning detectors in India.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. Thank goodness we weren't any nearer to it than 2 billion light years. I just find that absolutely amazing.
Yep. And just before we go, because the time is marching on as always quite quickly, the UK and European Space Agency are committing to funding for the Shetland satellite launch. And we'll go into a little bit more into that. Now, that's going to be hard to get to for us. It'll have to be a boat trip and another boat trip and a land trip and all that sort of stuff. So
that's what we can do. Thank you, John, for that. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to John for his news items and for driving the sound desk. And thanks to James Sweeney and Colonel Lennon for making the show available on astronomy.ie. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next, it's Bren Lynott with Threads. Then at 10 p.m. we have Nigel Wood with Ear to the Globe, and from midnight till 2 a.m. it's Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues and soul in a program called After Hours. But please join myself and John at the same time next week. That's 7:30 p.m. We'll be back then with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening and say goodnight, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.